Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, May 10th, 2017. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today for the entire hour is David Joy. But before we bring him on, let me say that what some of you know, maybe all of you know, especially if you listened in last week, is we're involved in our annual fund drive, actually biannual fund drive, right? Twice yearly, we are here asking you to donate to help us keep the lights on. And we have our co-hosts, Nicole Nelson and Marie Stone, here to talk about it with me. Hello.
Hi there, Barbara.
Hey. Hello.
So they are both out on the phones, 949-824-5824, hoping that you'll call and keep them company. How's it been going out there, Marie?
We just got a call. So somebody else had to run out. There's three of us here, and someone else had to run out and answer the phone because we just got a call. So we're waiting for a status on that. But we got some great donations last week.
We did. We had... actually, what we offered were book certificates, bookstore certificates, and we still have one left, a $20 bookstore certificate that you can shop online if you're out of area. And for $50 fund drive donation, you get the bookstore certificate, or there are CDs or tickets to events or other gift certificates and
surprise books. Right? Yeah. Aren't we? We're offering some books if
some
you
books
call in.
Too, and, yeah. If you want books. A book and you tell us what genre you like, and we will mail you a book. It will be a surprise. You can always request, but it will be a surprise. And this is really how we keep the lights on here, how we keep water in the water cooler. And we're all volunteers. And Writers on Writing has been on the air for 19 years. And next April, I think it is 20 years. And if we didn't have fund drives, the show certainly wouldn't be here all this time.
And we love the show so much. And I love fund drive season. I know you do too, Marie.
I do.
It's when we get to hear from our listeners and hear how much you appreciate the show too. So if you're one of those listeners, please do give us a call, 949-824-5824.
And if you are listening to this, and you can't make a call or you can't call in this hour, you can always go to kuci.org and donate. The fund drive is going on through the weekend, and just indicate that it's Writers on Writing that you listen to and love, so that we get a little credit here for your call in.
We've given. I gave $100 last week.
That's right.
And we all donate. And it's a labor. It's not even a labor of love. It's just fun love.
Yeah.
So
fun love.
Fun love.
Okay, well, let's get to our guests, and let's hope that we hear the phone ring. 824-5824. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
We are going to bring on our guest. My guest for the entire hour today is David Joy. He's the author of the Edgar-nominated novel, Where All Light Tends to Go. It was published by Putnam in 2015. He's also the author of the memoir Growing Gills, A Fly Fisherman's Journey, which was a finalist for the Reed Environmental Writing Award and the Reagan Old North State Award. David Joy is a recipient of an artist fellowship from the North Carolina Arts Council. His writing has appeared in numerous magazines and journals and has been nominated for awards such as the Pushcart Prize. His latest short stories and essays have appeared in The Good Men Project, Still the Journal, and the Pisgah Review. And he's here today to primarily talk about his new novel, The Weight of This World, published by Putnam this year, which I loved, and I'm so excited to talk with him. Hi, David.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You are certainly welcome. Let's talk about how The Weight of This World came about. Where did this story come from?
Well, I think for me, stories always start with some sort of image. And usually, you know, I just have this image that won't leave my mind. I usually kind of know some things And so, for instance, with Where All Light Tends to Go, that first novel, I had a very vivid image of a boy having killed a pig. I knew that his father was behind him. I knew that the boy was trying to hold back tears and that he was scared to let his emotions show. And really, that's all I knew when I started that novel. And it just never would leave. And so eventually, I kind of hear this voice of Jacob McNeely. With this second novel, very similar in the sense that I had an image of these two guys who were going to buy drugs from a guy that they had known their whole life. I knew that the guy had been taking in all of these stolen goods as payment, which is indicative of what we see here a lot. And I knew that he was showing off all of these guns to these guys and that he accidentally kills himself. And so there are these two addicts sitting here with a pile of drugs, a pile of money, and a body on the floor. And that was kind of the initial image I had. And so the novel kind of grew out of that. And it was just trying to figure out who those people were, how they got there, and where they were headed when they walked out the door.
Hmm. Well, I love the book. I wasn't sure how I was going to feel about it, and I don't even know how I found my way to it. But I found it somewhere, maybe looking at David Morrell or another writer, and I saw the description for this and so wanted to read it. And you know, I've lived in West Virginia, in the hollers of West Virginia, for a time, and I think for people who have never been in that area of the country and on south, it's easy to have a stereotyped idea of how people are. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think if you look at how Appalachia and Appalachians have been portrayed historically, it's kind of that Beverly Hillbillies, barefoot and pregnant stereotype, uneducated people, no teeth, and that's kind of what we've dealt with really for as long as we've existed. The reality is that I would say that the people here are no different than anywhere else in the world. I think that humanity, when you really break it down, is a pretty simplistic thing in that we're all dealing with the same type of issues. We all love, we all hate, we all laugh, we all cry. And so what I try to do with my work is get to the humanity of people. And that's really the only thing that interests me. And one of the things I think that I'm trying to do is to show people who have historically had their humanity stripped away from them, and I'm trying to showcase that human condition. George Saunders talked about literature serving as empathy's training wheels, and I love that idea, and I think that he's right. I think that literature and art in general are one of the few things that allows us to walk in somebody else's shoes for a little while. And so that's really what I think I'm trying to do with my work is kind of allow somebody to walk in the shoes of somebody they might otherwise dismiss.
This would be a great time to hear you read from The Weight of This World. Would you do that?
Yeah. Okay. And this section, really the only thing you need to know is that Thad Broome and Aidan McCall have been best friends their entire lives. They're early 20s here. Aiden has stayed behind in Jackson County while Thad has served in the military, and he's come home, and kind of these two friends who are still deeply tied together, almost, they're like brothers, but they've experienced their world experience at this point in time is drastically different. Thad has been away at war, and Aiden has stayed behind, and he's watched basically the economy collapse. And in this part of Appalachia, what that meant was watching all of the money pull from the housing market when the bubble collapsed. All the money pulled out. And so that's kind of where Aiden is. This is, at the Silva ABC store, Aiden waited in the car while Thad went inside to buy whatever whiskey was cheapest. Aiden was starved, and he hoped the job that night might ease things for a while, might get them enough cash to last a month. When the market fell to pieces, Aiden turned to stripping the same houses he'd helped build. Thad was right about how the world seemed backward, how it was easier to eke out a living than to hold an honest-to-God job. A man could put in a half-night's work for a full week's pay and never pay a dime in taxes. On top of that, the smart ones caught checks for unemployment or disability, so outlawing gets in a man's blood in such a way that even if there comes a day when he wants out, even if he gets tired of scraping by and wants to go honest, there isn't much of a demand. In that way, this day was no different than from any day that had come before, and that was part of what kept Aiden up at night, the cyclical nature of it all. For his entire life, everything had been a continuous whirling of disappointment, the circle seeming to tighten and become just a little more certain with each passing year. Small arrests led to small arrests, and rap sheets became resumes. Three-day sentences turned to 10 days turned to 30, and in a place like Jackson County, second chances were given, but third and fourth chances never happened. Aiden's reputation preceded him, and he was too broke to leave. Too broke to leave is what gets a man to do it again and again, and before he knows it, he's right back where he started. That's just the way the world turns. Every place has a backside, and that was all he'd ever known. In a county where 99% were hard-working, God-fearing people who do anything for one another, folks like Aiden and Thad were walking, talking prayer requests. That's a little section.
Thank you so much. If you just tuned in to hear that, that was David Joy reading from his new novel, The Weight of This World, published by Putnam. I must remind all of you out there that we have a fund drive going on. Please call and keep Nicole and Marie company out in the lobby where they are waiting for your call, 949-824-5824. And truly, any amount helps. If you have $5 to pledge, we'll take it. Premiums begin at $35, and at that level, there's a bunch of things you can request. $50 on up gets you different premiums. If you want to sit in with Writers on Writing one day, that's a $100 pledge. You can be with us here in the studio. So 949-824-5824 is the number. Show some love. We need to know if anybody's listening. I love that section that you read, David. As I've said, I love the entire novel. And I read something, I think the New York Times called your book Bleakly Beautiful, which is an interesting way of putting it. How do you feel about that?
I think most of the stories I tell are pretty dark stories. I think a lot of people aren't willing to go to the places that I write about. I think that it takes a brave reader to go into the world that I talk about and to do so deeply. But I also think that if you're willing to go there, there's an immense beauty. And I think that there's also something that you gain from that experience. You know, I think I don't want to write easy books. I want to write books that challenge readers to go into places that they typically wouldn't want to go. And I want them to ask big questions, and I want them to ask hard questions and to have hard conversations. I think one of the biggest roles of literature is to create some type of meaningful dialogue. And so I think that idea of my work being bleak, I think, is spot on right. But I like that phrasing because it means that they're also seeing, what I'm working so hard to create, which is the beauty behind all of that.
Why do you think you're attracted to the dark side? How did that happen, do you think?
I think part of it was growing up. You know, I grew up, and a lot of people mistake what I'm trying to say here because my home life was actually, really good. But I grew up in a place where I was, I was surrounded by poverty. I was surrounded by hard scrabble lives. I was surrounded by drugs. I was surrounded by violence. And so I think really early on, You know, I kind of saw that world, and I also saw how that world was portrayed by those in privileged places. And you know, I think really that's where it comes from. I think it comes from, you know, being around those people all my life, seeing that they were you know, just as human as anyone else, and wanting to try and capture that. You know, this latest book is dedicated to a buddy of mine named Paco, and I grew up with Paco. Wonderful guy. You know, we had tons of great times growing up. And he joined the Marines. He was part of he joined the Marines after 9/11, and he was kind of part of that initial you know, drop 100,000 troops on the shore and head toward Baghdad to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And when he came back, you know, I would say that he was different, you know. But one day he walked into his house and he shot his brother and he shot his father and he killed himself. And I can remember how that story was portrayed on the news, and I can remember how they stripped him of his humanity. And I think this latest novel, in a lot of ways, comes out of me trying to deal with that. I think this book is very much a treatise on violence, and I think this book is very much an examination of post-traumatic stress. And the latter, with post-traumatic stress, the only time we ever hear that conversation is in regards to veterans. But with this novel, every one of these characters is suffering from some form of post-traumatic stress. You know, we never hear about that conversation in regards to victims of sexual assault or victims of childhood trauma. And I think what I was wanting to do was that if you can open that up and you can create a conversation that is inclusive of all of these other individuals, then suddenly people don't feel so alone in the world. And suddenly somebody who's coming back from war doesn't have to just rely on other people who have witnessed war. He can see that, hey, there are lots of people like me. There are lots of people who have experienced, you know, overwhelmingly emotional situations, who are trying to cope with that and get past that and live with that. And if you can create a conversation like that, I think there's an immense power in that.
Mm. So then your character Thad is based on Paco, I'm guessing.
In a lot of ways, yeah. At the same time, you know, not in any way except that he's a soldier who's come mm-hmm. back to the mountains, who's trying to cope with what he's witnessed and at war. You know, he wound up being kind of a culmination of a whole lot of things. You know, I read a lot of books. I watched a lot of interviews. I watched a lot of documentaries. I talked with a lot of people, and he kind of became this culmination of all of those things.
Interesting. Well, one theme running through your work is also friendship, and I love the friendship between Thad and Aiden. I'm guessing that was there from the start as well.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I could see, you know, with that initial image, I could see those two, and I knew that they weren't brothers, but I knew they might as well be, and so I was trying to, you know, figure out who they were and how that came about. You know, I think in the mountains, especially, but in the mountains, you know, family is a really tight-knit thing here, probably more so than it is in urban areas now. You know, I think that, you know, the urban-rural divide is largely a matter of displacement. You know, family units aren't as tight as they once were in urban areas. But in the country, you know, that's all we have. You know, that's all we have is family. And that also extends to community, and it also extends to friendships. You know, I had a friend tell me one time, he said, the only thing that matters at the end of the day, is who's standing with you at the end of that long, hard day, you know, and I think he's right. I think that's the only thing that matters in the world is if you could call one person, who's going to show up? And you know, with Aiden McCall, it's Thad Broom. You know, if he were to call him, he'd be there.
Hmm. So a little bit on sort of the process and the craft. You have a prologue, and it's quite a lengthy prologue, and I think it's a great way of opening the book. On this show, we talk a lot about prologues, and because they're somewhat controversial whether to have one or not, and do readers skip over prologues or not, and is it better just to work it into the book or have it be really, really short? Will you talk about your prologue, and at what point did it come?
I think it came when I recognized what Aiden was dealing with. You know, it's given nothing away to discuss what happens in the opening page of this book. You've got a 12-year-old kid who's sitting in the living room of his house. His father comes into the house, shoots his mother, and kills himself. And you've got a kid who's orphaned. That happens within three paragraphs of this book. And so, for me, the prologue came when I realized why Aiden was the way that he was, and so, you know, I think it just kind of grew out of that. I understand what you're saying. I think a lot of times people put a prologue or a epilogue into a book, trying to be literary or artsy. I don't know. With me, it was very much that prologue has to be there. That prologue sets up a friendship that's tighter than blood. And so when we jump ahead 12 years, you know, when all of a sudden these people are 24 years old instead of 12, then we know how close they are, and we know how close they are because of what we witnessed in the beginning. And then with the epilogue, I think the prologue epilogue for this novel became kind of a really nice framework, because the novel takes place over an incredibly short period of time. You know, the action of the novel takes place over 3 days. And so what the prologue and the epilogue allow is a before and an after. And so we get to see kind of what set all of this up, and then we kind of get to see the fallout, you know, afterward. And so I don't think that this novel would work any other way.
Well, yeah, speaking of the epilogue, endings actually are hard, or harder even than beginnings and middles, I think, because endings, at least for me, are what make you want to read the author's next book. And I just loved your ending, and it's right up there with my favorite novel endings, because I love it when the true climax of the story really comes at the very end, and not a third of the way from the end, or even a quarter of the way from the end, but at the end. Will you talk about the ending and the epilogue, and when did you know how the weight of this world was going to end?
I think with most of my novels, there tends to be an inevitability about them, you know, and so with Where All Light Tends to Go, I think anybody who started that story knew that things, you know, weren't going to end well. I'm not a fan of happy endings. You know, at the same time, I would say endings typically come more easily for me than anything else. And part of that is when I start getting toward the end of the book, there's a propulsion that's happening as far as writing, where it kind of all just comes at once. And so with both of these first two novels, I think it was very much, you know, a case of things happening really quickly in my mind, and just trying to get it down. As far as with this novel, Aiden is plagued by by a severe fear of being left behind, of being alone. That's how the novel starts. That's how the novel ends. When I talked earlier about all three of these characters suffering from post-traumatic stress, you know, with Thad, it's war. With April, who's Thad's mother, it's that she was a victim of sexual assault. And with Aiden, it's very much a matter of him witnessing his parents die at such an early age, and then feeling like there was no one there for him. And so all of his decision making, and it's happening unconsciously. He doesn't know why he's making the decisions that he's making. As a reader and as a writer, I think I can recognize that the reason he's making the decisions he's making is because he doesn't want to be left alone. That's his biggest fear in the world. And so, I think that had to be the end. That had to be the last line of that novel. And then the other side of, I think in a strange way, at the end of this novel, Aiden in some ways feels like a Christ figure. He feels like he wishes that all of the issues of the world could have been piled on his back and his back alone, so that the rest of the world wouldn't have had to suffer. And so, there's a line there at the end that, you know, when he's about to do what he's about to do at the end of this book, where he says, if nothing else, he's pricked a pinhole in the darkness. Mm. And I think that's very much Aiden McCall.
Yeah, excellent. Before we go to break, I wanted to say something about, and again, I think I read it somewhere, and if I didn't, I would call this book, I would put this in the noir category, because it, you know, like you said, it doesn't end cheerily. It's the ending is very dark as well. What do you think? Would you call it Appalachian Noir? What would you call it? Or if you had to put it on a shelf in the store, where would it go?
I like that idea of noir, and I like that idea because, I think what the French were trying to describe with that term is mood. You know, they were trying to say that there's an atmosphere about, they were using it in regards to film, but that there was an atmosphere that kind of overshadowed the entire piece of art. And with all of my work, I would definitely say that there's a dark shadow cast over all of it. I'm not interested in happy endings because for the most part, I don't think they happen. I don't think that that's realism. So, I like that term.
Well, we're going to take a real short break. David, stay with us. I'm going to bring Nicole and Marie back in, and we're going to talk about the fun drive. How's it going out there?
It's super quiet.
It is super quiet.
We don't like quiet.
Does anybody listen, or does anybody love us?
The shocking thing is that I get so many emails after shows and texts from listeners after shows saying, I love that show. I learned so much. And so I'd love to hear from you now. I'd love to.
You know, you both know this story, but, and maybe I've even talked about it on the last Fun Drive, but there was one listener who was also a guest on the show, I think Edward Kelso, but he is a cellist in Chicago. And he told me that when he wanted to start writing, basically what he did was listen to the show, listen to all the shows, go into the archives and use it as sort of his own little MFA program. And afterward, he's written at least two novels that have made the bestseller list. So, it's useful.
It makes a lot of sense because we have so many great writers. We have award-winning writers, but we also have fabulous debut authors who bring a different perspective. And I just learn so much every show I listen to. And I'm a fan, and I know we have lots of fans, and it's 949-824-5824.
Yes, pledges at any level, and I want to thank Laguna Beach Books in Laguna Beach, Lido Village Books in Newport Beach and Mystery Inc. Bookstore in Huntington Beach for donating gift certificates. And I also want to thank Larissa, Sherry Keith, and Ann Dunham and Cindy Christensen for donating to the show. I so appreciate it. And when you do that, at whatever pledge level, it tells me that you appreciate the show and that we should keep going.
And if there was ever a time to donate to public radio, commercial-free radio, you know, with where we are in the world, the arts, I think, mean more than anything at any other time in our, at least in my lifetime. And so I'm kind of doubling down on my arts efforts. I'm giving to museums, I'm giving to libraries, and should give to the show.
Oh, I think the phone's ringing. Thank you, you guys.
Thank you. Call us.
Call us, 949-824-5824. Again, any level pledge is appreciated, truly. We're going to bring David Joy back on. So, David, we have so much more to talk about, and I'm just looking at my list here of what I want to talk about because there's too much, but... Killing. David is author of The Weight of This World, published by Putnam. And it's such a pleasure to have authors on whose books I love. And I plowed through this one. I just really loved it. And as I was reading, though, I also read as a writer because I'm a writer. And I wondered about killing off characters. So often in novels, we need to do this, whether it's, you know, whatever genre this happens, or if not killing off characters, at least making their lives extremely difficult. Will you talk about that, how you do that and how that affects you?
I think one of the big things that a writer has to do is that, you know, a novel or a story or anything else is nothing without some sort of conflict. And so, you know, and I'm not interested in a slow build to conflict. I'm interested in trying to create a story or a novel that is very propulsive from the beginning. You know, I'm very much am coming out of writers like Larry Brown or Ron Rash or Daniel Woodrell. But when I think of a writer like Daniel Woodrell, you know, the first time I read Tomato Red, I finished the first chapter and I read it the rest of the day over and over and over again, trying to figure out how he created the propulsion that he created in that first chapter, because he makes you read 10 or 15 pages before he allows you to take a breath. That's incredibly interesting to me. And so one of the ways I think that you do that is that you start with a character who's already backed against a wall, and that there's something coming towards them. You know, it's not much different than, you know, backing a dog into a corner. You know, the dog's either going to cower down or the dog's going to bite you. And most of the dogs I've ever known, they're going to bite you. And so characters that I create typically are already backed against the wall. And I think that allows for a narrative that starts very, very quickly. And so that's one of the things I'm doing. As far as, you know, killing off characters, I don't think that I don't go into it thinking about it. I actually don't go into a story thinking about much of anything except for that I want to know where they're going. You know, I'm not somebody who outlines things. I'm not somebody who plots things out. When I get to the end, and I'm equally as surprised as the readers are to find out what's happened. You know, I was with a writer recently named Julia Franks, a really great writer. She wrote a novel called Over the Plain Houses that was NPR Book of the Year. But she said that when she starts a novel, she said, the only thing I know is the ending. She said, and then it's a matter of trying to figure out, okay, how did this happen? And I said, for me, if I knew the ending, I wouldn't write the book. Mm. And I wouldn't. You know, if I know the ending, then I'm done. You know, for me, that's part of the process, is very much trying to figure out what's going to happen. And so from one page to the next, I don't know what's going to happen. And so when characters, you know, eventually, you know, are killed or die, you know, I don't think that it's anything that I've consciously thought about. It's just, you know, where the story wound up going.
Well, you know, before we go on, you're listening to KUCI FM in Irvine, and the opinions and views that you hear on this show are not those of the University of California Regents, but those of my guests and me. And my guest today, for the remaining time we have, is David Joy. His new book is The Weight of This World, published by Putnam. So, David Woodrell is the author that led me to you. I don't know how I found his novel, Tomato Red, but then somehow, maybe it was on Audible, I linked to yours, and yours sounded just so interesting. It's interesting how we find our way to books, but... So I'm also curious, when did you know when this would become a multiple point of view novel?
I was getting away from that first novel is first person. That first novel, where all light tends to go, is very much a novel that is a matter of voice. And it's a singular voice that carries it. But I also found that to be incredibly limiting, in the sense that it limits the language that you're able to use. You know, there were times when my instinct would have been to thicken a sentence up, you know, but I couldn't because the story was being told in voice. And so, for one, I was moving away from first person into third. But the other thing that third person allows you to do is third person allows you to move around in a novel. And so when I think about a story, I try to think about who, you know, if there are three people in a room, who's got the most interesting perspective? And so with this story, there are definitely three main characters at play over the course of this time period, and that being, you know, Aidan McCall, Thad Broome, and Thad's mother, April. And so it was really a matter of thinking who had the most interesting perspective, you know, and it's also a matter of they were deserving of a voice. You know, they had something to say. They had something to add to it. And so... I think I find that interesting, you know, to try and think about, to not only see a scene, but to try and see a scene from multiple points of view and figure out which one needs to tell the story.
I love that. I have to write that down. Who has the most interesting perspective? That's such a great way of thinking about it and who to give voice to in a novel. That's great. How'd you figure that out?
I don't know. I think the other thing that perspective allows is humanity. And so with the very first novel, Where All Light Tends to Go, there were so many people who told me that they couldn't see the humanity of Jacob's father, or they couldn't mm-hmm. see the humanity of Jacob's mother. Part of the problem as a writer was that the people I was writing about are not the kind of people who are going to sit down and have a heart-to-heart conversation where they open up and share their emotions. It's just not going to happen. And if that's not going to happen, then it becomes impossible to get inside their heads and show why they're making the decisions that they're making. And so when I switched to third, it was incredibly freeing in the sense that all of a sudden you're able to get to that humanity. And so, you know, another reason that now that I'm thinking about it is when I first saw April in this story, I knew that April hated her son. She hated Thad. And that's an incredibly hard thing to say about a woman. You know, I think that in the traditional sense, you know, when we think of women as mothers, I think that's maybe one of the most horrible things that you can say is that this woman hates her child. And so it became really important for me to try and figure out why. And if you can explain why, then it doesn't, you know, wash it away, and it doesn't condone it, but it does help you understand. And you know, I think that's part of that, you know, that idea of empathy again.
Well, yeah, because that was an interesting, part of April, and yet I empathized with her. I didn't dislike her because of it, and I found her such an interesting character. That's really interesting.
I'm glad it worked.
And if you're enjoying the show, maybe you're listening online, you can always go online to kuci.org and donate. Please indicate that you are a fan of Writers on Writing so we get a little credit. And we do have a few minutes left. Nicole and Marie are out there at the phones. I've seen it, I've heard it ring a few times, and I've seen the light in the studio flash, so I know a couple of you called at least. The number is 949-824-5824. Make us happy. Make us feel loved. Please call. David, would you talk a little bit about your revision process? Because you said you don't plot, and so I'm guessing that when it comes time to revise, I'm not going to guess anything. How does that go? What's your process like?
I tend to revise a lot, and that's really the part that I enjoy the most. I always use this metaphor, but my mother was a potter, and when I think about the first draft of something, I think about it like going and digging clay. And digging clay isn't fun, you know. It's work. And after you've dug clay and after you've taken it back and refined it, well, then you get to put it on a wheel and make something beautiful out of it, and that's revision. It's very much that one is incredibly laboring. I say it's like digging a ditch, and it is. It's, you know, a first draft is work. Revision is very much when it's fun. You know, it's when you can start to see things. It's when you get to sand it down. And so for me, I love revision. And I tend to go, I don't know, I probably have five drafts when I send it to my editor. And then, you know, we might wind up with another five. With where all light tends to go, I might have wound up having 15 or so drafts. And with where all light tends to go, when I say revision, I mean major revisions. The character of Maggie in that novel was completely rewritten start to finish. With The Weight of This World, it's a similar thing. You know, you go in and you have to look at it with fresh eyes. I've got a great editor, and I've got a great agent, and both of them have incredible eyes, and they can help me see things that I couldn't see beforehand. I always tell them that at the end of the day, I wish that my novels had all three of our names on the front, because they, you know, at the end of the day, there is a lot of Sarah, who's my editor. There is a lot of Sarah that winds up into my novels. There's a lot of Julia, who's my agent, that winds up into these novels. And without their eyes, you know, I don't think that the end product would be nearly as good as it hopefully it winds up being.
So I'm guessing you have the same agent for this book that you got for the first book?
Yeah.
Can you
yeah.
talk about how that happened? Did you send out a bunch of query letters? Was it a referral? Did you send out one query letter and get an agent? How'd that go?
Yeah, I'm kind of the, the definition of if I can do it, anybody can do it. Because I don't have an MFA. I don't have... you know, a whole lot of connections in the literary world. I definitely didn't at the time. I just had a story to tell. And so, you know, I wrote a novel. When I finished the novel, and it was about that fifth draft, when I finished that fifth draft, I'd been up for about 2 days, and I'd spent about the last 9 hours on the last paragraph of that book. And it was about 4 o'clock in the morning. And I finished it, and I was like, this is perfect. And I wrote a query letter. At the time, who I wanted to represent me was Ellen Levine, who is Daniel Woodrell's agent. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a query letter. I hit send on an email in the middle of the night, and I passed out. I woke up the next morning, and the very first thought that came to me was like, you know, what the hell did you do? I thought I'd made this horrible mistake, you know. And looking back, I probably did. But about an hour later, I get an email, and they had read the sample, and she requested a full. And at that point, I knew that I had something. You know, I knew that I had something valuable because in the grand scheme of things, Ellen Levine is, I think, you know, one of the best agents in the literary world. And the fact that she wanted to read it meant something. And so she wound up passing, but I sent it to, I think I only sent it to two others. I sent it to Nat Sobel, who represents a bunch of writers who were similar to me, and I sent it to Julia Kinney because Julia said that she liked dark fiction. And I wound up, you know, signing with Julia, and it's been a great relationship. But so, you know, I have this very vivid memory of going to New York, and I don't remember if it was the first time I had to go to New York to sign contracts or if it was later. But I can remember standing in this hotel and looking out over that city and thinking, the only reason I'm here is because I sent a letter. Because up until then, I'd never left North Carolina. You know, I'd never been anywhere. You know, I wouldn't have gone anywhere. And I sent a letter, and that's how it all started. I didn't do anything else. I didn't get an MFA. I didn't have somebody reach out to an agent. I sent a letter.
You know, we have so much more to talk about. I might have to convince you to do something on the blog, a Q&A blog, you know, thing going on the blog, because I have so many more questions. But, you know, it does sound that with your agent that you did research, the proper research, to find an agent who represented work similar to yours. And that seems to be one aspect of finding an agent that we often miss as writers. You know, there's an agent we love. Maybe that agent doesn't represent anything like what we do, but we love that agent. And we send to those agents and we get rejected. And then we wonder why.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you got to do your homework I think a lot of times people, you know, they get on, I don't know what the name of that, like Publishers Marketplace, I think, maybe.
Sure.
But there's a couple of those sites where it gives agent information, and it shows their sales, you know, the recent books they've sold. I don't think that's anywhere to look. If Julia hadn't sold a book at that point, that wouldn't have mattered to me. What mattered to me was that she understood what I was trying to do. She knew how to help me make it better, and she loved the work. I told her in the very beginning, I said, I want somebody who is willing to punch somebody in the mouth for me. and what I meant by that is that I'm in North Carolina. I can't walk into those places and try to convince them why they need to publish this. And that's what I want an agent to do, is I want an agent to walk into a room and convince the people there, you know, why what I'm doing matters. And that's what she did. And yeah, it was just a matter of, you know, researching people, figuring out, you know, I know who I'm writing like, I know where I'm rooted, And so then seeing who represents those people, who likes that stuff. I think it's actually pretty simple process, you know, especially with the internet.
Yeah. And probably the business of writing is the one thing most writers do not enjoy, right? We just want to write. We want to get our stuff published, but we don't want to have to do all the businessy stuff that, you know, isn't really a lot of fun. I mean, it's just a lot of unpleasant work and putting ourselves out there and dealing with rejection and all the other stuff that comes along with the writing life.
Yeah.
Well, we are at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any advice for the listeners, the writers who are listening, or any advice you've received along the way that has stuck with you.
I think we'll end with saying that they need to call and donate to the program. I mean, I think what one of the people said earlier about us being in a place where the arts are endangered is a very, very real threat. I don't know if any of the listeners watch CBS Sunday Morning or not, but a couple weeks ago they had this special on Apple Shop in Kentucky, which is this great art program that's existed since right after the War on Poverty started, but a lot of that money comes from the National Endowment for the Arts, and they're, you know, if we want arts to still matter, if we want art to still be relevant, if we still want to live in a world where we're showing one another that we care about one another, where we're trying to create empathy, I don't know of anything that has that power more than literature, more than art, and we need to put our money where our mouth is and support the people who are trying to do that.
Well said. Thank you so much, and thank you for being on the show, David.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
That was David Joy. His novel is The Weight of This World, published by Putnam. And now I have Nicole and Marie back. Did anything happen out there?
We had a few calls.
You had a few calls. What happened?
Yes. Well, a listener, Leslie Burns, called and
very cool.
Pledged. And also Carol Nelson called in.
Excellent. Oh, that's great.
Did you know she goes by Nikki?
No.
Yes, Nikki. Nicole goes by Nikki. I know that.
Went past tense.
I think only her mom gets away with that.
People. Yeah.
She said, I'm Nikki's mom. And I'm like, I don't know Nikki. And she's like, it's Nicole.
Well, we appreciate any pledge. And thank you, Carol and Leslie. And I'm reading here about some fun facts about KUCI and pledging. And right here it says, a $35 pledge is actually only $2.92 a month, or 67 cents a week, or 9.5 cents a day for 24 hours of programming. And so this show will cost you 67 cents a week. I think that's like,
that's remarkable.
That
yes.
is remarkable. And it's remarkable that somebody figured that out.
That's better math than I know.
So, and with so many podcasts to listen to, you can right. double your value.
Double your value. All of these shows go right. up on podcasts. They're all on iTunes. This morning, I accidentally entered Writers on Writing in Google, and I came. I arrived right at iTunes, which surprised me, actually, and all the podcasts right there. So they're easy to find, and they're free. And the number is 949-824-5824. We have a few minutes for you to call and for us to get credit, or you can donate online at kuci.org and request a premium. And even $5 or $10 it means more than you know.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, but do you have, over the course of the last 19 years, do you have favorites that have stood out that have just been remarkable interviews?
Oh, my gosh. You tell me.
A lot.
A lot. I know. I mean,
a lot.
It's, you know, when I mean, I always think of Dennis Palumbo, who is a psychologist in L.A., who's been on a few times, always sort of shrinking the writers who are listening and helping everybody feel a little better about process and about dealing with just the trials we go through. And so probably David is one of my favorites. I seem to run his show when I need to run a show at the last minute if a guest cancels or I'm out of town or something.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I've always enjoyed George Saunders. He's
George
come on a couple
Saunders,
of times.
Yes.
So generous. So generous with his advice and with his time and with his insights. And he's been a favorite.
And two podcasts, Lincoln in the Bardo and
the 10th of December.
They're both online. You can go to our archive, actually, writersonwriting.blogspot.com and pull those up and listen to George. And he's like that in real life too.
He is.
You know?
He is. Like, he's incredibly generous, incredibly sweet. There used to be a time when you could just pull him aside and have a beer with him, I hear. A couple of writers I've talked to have gotten, CJ, who did an interview here, said he had a beer with George Saunders. I'm like, that's great.
That's great. So we are at the end of our time. We're gonna leave you now and hope that somebody is the last caller during the show. Do we have a gift certificate left or no?
The Mystery Inc. gift certificate is still available.
Okay, it's still available, and they have an online shop, so you can order books online. And again, thank you, Laguna Beach Books and Lido Village Books and Mystery Inc. Bookstore for offering gift certificates. And all of you out there, thank you for listening, and make that call. We'll be back next week.